This is James Jacobson Nasals for Yeshivat Hadar. This is the second in our series on texts on mindfulness in Jewish sources. And today, as in the previous podcast, we'll be continuing an exploration of some texts of Rabbi Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, the Pizetzner Rebbe, on this subject of quietness, on the subject of mindfulness, particularly in connection with the Inyan HaShketa, the quieting technique, which we studied together last time. Today we'll consider how this technique is used and the ways in which it appears in a number of his other texts. And we'll begin with a text from Derech HaMelech, a series of drashot of his written before the war. And there he tells us in Parsha Bereishit the following. And he says, this is also possibly counsel, good advice, how a person can come to arousal, awakening, and the revelation of the divine portion within him without awakening his self-interest. That is, how does one awaken and arouse the divine self, the genuine self, perhaps even the place of no self, but the place of open divine presence, without at the same time arousing one's own ego and particular sense of self? And he says this works actually by going beyond speech, that is through waiting, pausing an hour or some portion of time before prayer. And of course, this is a reference to the famous Mishnah Brachot, which tells us that the Chassidim Rishonim, the early pietists, the early spiritual practitioners, used to wait for an hour before they daven. And one of the classic questions on that Mishnah is, what exactly does it mean for them to shohin, for them to wait for an hour? What did they do in that hour, in that time period before they daven, that readied them for the experience of encountering the divine? And here the Pizetzner is now going to tell us his concrete understanding of what that waiting, what that pausing actually was. Because, as was mentioned above, in every Jew, in everything a person does, there is an aspect of divinity. The problem is just that a person hides this from himself through his thoughts, his desires, and all his matters. So the fundamental claim here, which is actually, I think, quite essential to many Jewish understandings of mindfulness, is that our essential nature, our identity, is in fact divine. And our divine nature is always present there if we are willing to turn our attention to it. It is simply that it is hidden from ourselves. And not hidden from some external or by some external force, but actually hidden by the operation of our very own small self, by precisely our thoughts, our desires, and the matters of the world with which we are involved. And indeed, we saw last time that the Pizetzner made the same claim. The fundamental blocks to our ability to be present with our actual experience and therefore to open to our divine nature and the divine nature of the world was thought and desire, or more precisely, our being caught up in, imprisoned in, tempted by, addicted to, and seduced by our thoughts and desires. And when we are lost in that unceasing flow of thought and desire, as we are, in fact, most of the time, then the divine nature of reality and of our own selves is, in fact, hidden from us. And he continues, Ad shegama kedusha va'af mida kedusha kiyira shemitgalet lo ayadei inyanav nireit lo yira shelo yireu ish. And this is to such an extent that even holiness, even an aspect of holiness such as awe, which is revealed to him through his matters, which happens actually in the midst of his matters of the world, which itself, of course, is an interesting claim, because as he mentioned above, our thoughts and desires and inyanav, the matters of the world, are what block us from sensing divinity. But in fact, this divinity is revealed through those very aspects, through our thoughts and desires and matters. It is simply that our way of paying attention to it causes them to be hidden from us. And so when one is caught up in the wrong kind of attention in these matters, such as the matters of the world in which we all deal, then even an actual revelation of the divine in the midst of it, such as an experience of awe, actually seems to him as something peculiar and wrong and something he shouldn't be experiencing, an awe which he should not, which a person should not have, as the text says. In a fundamental sense, the Bezetzner claims, we are lost. We are alienated from our own true nature and the true nature of the world. We become alienated from our own nature and that which is most natural for us, really. That which is most appropriate for us becomes instead bizarre and strange, something alien and frightening. Indeed, the Bezetzner claims this is often our attitude to spirituality in general. While spirituality, in truth for him, is in fact touching and revealing our genuine divine self, we often find it to be a peculiar or bizarre or alienating experience, either the experience of touching for a moment our own spirituality or spiritual nature, or being in the presence of others actually trying to have a genuine spiritual experience. And so, the Bezetzner says, there, however, is a way to deal with this kind of alienation and confusion. But if he was to just stand and cease for an hour or for a moment, the flow of his thoughts and desires, and that's this key, this unceasing flow of thought and desires, then the aspect of divinity in him would be revealed to him without any enclosing, without any covering. In fact, he would have a direct revelation of the divine simply from this sensation of thought and desire. If just for a moment he was not caught in that flow, but was able to cease from it and be outside of it. Rak kevan she'adam rodef achar machshvotav, ma yaseh machar, eich yitpanes, eich yitkabed, lechen kol machshvotav shotfot b'li hefsek. But it's only because a person pursues his thoughts. What will he do tomorrow? How will he support himself? How will he be honored? Therefore, his thoughts flow without ceasing. Again, here a fascinating claim. It is not simply the nature of thought to flow unceasingly, but in fact, we feed our thoughts by pursuing them. And if you take the time to observe the nature of your mind, you will see that this is actually the case. Thoughts arise, and we immediately jump on the thought and make something else out of it and tell some story and develop some idea, and all of a sudden a whole chain of thoughts has happened. But if we stop just for a moment that process of pursuit, if we deprive that thought of its fuel, that fuel of our attachment to it, the thought often simply disappears. And the key to this pursuit, as the Bezetzner explains here, are actually thoughts which revolve around our ego and our self-concerns. Thoughts about the future and the past. Thoughts about how we're going to provide for ourselves. Are we going to be okay? Are we going to be safe? Thoughts about whether we're going to be okay and safe emotionally. Are we going to be honored? Are we going to be respected? Are we going to get what we think we need to get out of the world? And for that reason, because we feed the thoughts and we feed them actually with our own ego concerns and desires, our thoughts continue unceasingly. But he says this is what the Mishnah says. V'zeshe amra ha-Mishnah. This is as the Mishnah says, which it says, repent one day before your death. That a person should think that he does not have, God forbid, a tomorrow. And he should not think about tomorrow. And tomorrow should not bother his thoughts. And so the way to let go of this unceasing flow here actually is to come back to the moment. Let go of tomorrow. Let go of what's about to be. Not that it's never okay to think about tomorrow. There are appropriate times for that. But right now at this point when we're trying to open to the presence of the divine, open to our actual nature, to just let go for a minute of tomorrow, to let go for a minute of yesterday, and just be with what's happening right now. And indeed, as in other places, a powerful aid for that can be the awareness of the fleetingness of life, of our vulnerability and mortality. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't even know if we're going to have a tomorrow. And with that realization, we can commit instead to the present moment. The only moment, in fact, that we always have. And this is what it means to pause for a moment before the tefillah, before prayer. Shohin v'hu nishar omed b'dato u'machshvotav. He pauses and he remains standing or remains steady in his consciousness and in his thoughts. That is, he stops for a moment. And instead of being pulled after each thought, instead of pursuing each thought, instead of being lost in each thought, he now remains steady as thoughts cease, or as thoughts arise and pass away, but there's no need for him to lose himself in the flow. Va'az ahava v'yira Torah, shebichinat atzilut shelo titgalelo. And then, pure love and awe of the aspect of atzilut, of emanation, the highest aspect of divinity, the highest aspect of the self, the highest aspect of reality in the Kabbalistic scheme, this atzilut of his, this highest aspect of the self, will be revealed to him. That is, in that moment of cessation, the moment when he stops and is no longer lost in the flow, then in fact he doesn't even have to do anything. Automatically, as a result of that very cessation, as the result of presence, as the result of stopping, the fundamental spiritual experiences and virtues in Judaism and in Chassidut, of ahava v'yira, of love and awe, automatically emerge, and pure love and awe, because that in fact is his genuine nature, simply waiting there to be uncovered when he's willing to stop. And then these deeper, higher, more profound, more open, more divine aspects of himself are revealed to him, are made available to him in that very moment. Again, what's fascinating here is that he doesn't have to search them out. All he has to do is bring his attention. All he has to do is be willing to stop for a moment, to not be caught in the normal flows of thought and desire in which he's normally trapped. And by stopping, that higher portion, that divine portion, that place of love and awe, of joy and openness and compassion, is available to him at every moment. Yet this practice of mindfulness for the Bezetzner, this practice of cessation and observation, is not only a formal practice. Last time, we saw its utilization as a formal meditation practice, combined with a series of other practices to bring one to awareness and consciousness of divinity, and to allow one to cultivate certain positive midot, certain positive qualities in the self. Today, so far, we've seen it as a particular kind of practice in preparation for prayer, in order to open oneself to the presence of the divinity, and therefore to pray in a genuine way. But we will see in the text that follow that it is a practice which is also to be utilized simply in everyday life, in our encounters and struggles with the everyday mundane world. The next text we'll consider is from his work Hachsharat Avreichim, The Preparation of the Young Scholar, a book which is directed towards young scholars, young students, and how they need to deal with their educational and spiritual development. The text from Chapter 9, Part 4 of the work begins as follows. Habet b'kirbecha ishomeo makshi. Look within yourself, you listening and attentive person. V'tireh shechok hu ba'adam. Im yitapel be'eze rachash mirachashe nafsho. Im hu rachash shel dimyon, ratzon, or hagasha. Ava yirao sh'ar midot. Av gami machshavato yitapel. In tipu machshavato hu b'harachash. Az ha'yodea tipul yosif harachash li'pael yoter. Yitchazek yitrageish yoter. Says, if a person starts to deal with, to care for, some kind of rustling in the soul, whether it's a rustling of some kind of imagination, of some kind of vision, or desire, or a feeling, of love, of awe, or of the rest of the qualities, including if he's sort of thinking about it, if he's engaging it with his consciousness. If he does engage it directly with his consciousness, if he's working on it, if he's engaging with it, then through that engagement, the rustling, the activation of his soul in whatever quality we're talking about here, becomes more active. It becomes stronger, and it becomes more emotional. This, of course, is an experience we've all had, that if there's something happening inside of us, we're having some emotional experience, or we're bringing somebody to mind or remembering some event, if we start to focus on that and really to bring it to mind in a stronger way, then that experience becomes stronger and more vivid and more present to us. V'im ein tipul ha-machshava b'harachash, rak odot ha-rachash, odot ha-dimyon, odot ha-ratzon, odot ha-va-vira v'chulei, ad ad-rabba al-yadei tipul ha-machshava odot, yikalesh ha-rachash, af yechdal le-gamri. But he says, if we use our consciousness, our thought, our mind, and we don't deal with the thing itself, we're not actually dealing with the experience, but rather what we're doing is we're dealing about the experience, about the visualization. That is, we are looking on it instead of thinking about it. The language here is difficult, this use of a dot, but what becomes clear from this text and later texts is that his claim here is that there are two different ways for us to engage in some experience we're having. One way is to actually take part in and lose ourselves in the experience, and this actually can be a very valuable thing. And when we do that, that experience is actually accentuated and grows. But here, when he uses this term odot, he's saying rather there's an alternative way of paying attention, which is to gaze upon or look at the experience, rather than to actually enter into and participate in the experience, let's say the memory, to let's say think the memory or remember the memory. What happens if we just pay attention to and watch the process of memory itself? We note that we are experiencing a memory. And that's true here, whether it's, as he says, about some kind of visualization, whether we're observing a desire, whether we're observing some kind of quality within us, such as love or awe, etc. When we do it that way, it's in fact the opposite of the way in which we think about it when we do it itself. Rather, the experience itself is weakened, and sometimes it ceases entirely. And this is as we saw above, when we actually start to bring our attention to the thing, rather than to lose ourselves in it, when we are inclined to observe it instead, to observe those thoughts and desires, then those thoughts and desires actually often, in fact, cease, or at least become less strong in their pull upon us. V'lo ha-tipul levad, rak gam ha-histaklut ba'atzma, she'adam mistakel b'machshavato al ezer rachash asher b'kribo, av al machshavato, makeh et ha-rachash ve'et ha-machshava. And he says it's not just about dealing with or involving oneself in this process, but also this process of gazing itself. And of course, this term is very interesting. It indicates that kind of third-party perspective on our own experience, which is part of the practice of mindfulness, and which we saw described earlier in the technique of quieting, which we discussed in the last podcast. So he says this gazing itself, this looking, when a person gazes upon his thought, or on some experience, some agitation which is happening within. It might be an emotional experience, a memory, an image, looking at some kind of quality or personality trait. It really doesn't matter what it is. And even, as he says, al machshavato, even on his thought himself, he can turn that gazing to the very operation of his consciousness. Then it dims, it causes to fade that experience, and even the thought itself. When we bring our attention to it, as we discussed in the last text, in the one hand, it simply takes away the energy that was the fuel of that experience, the energy which kept that experience going in a simple cause and effect reaction. When we take away that energy, then nothing is fueling that experience anymore, and a space, a certain kind of space of openness, a space of openness where the divine is found, then becomes available to us. But to do so, we need to keep a few things in mind as made clear by this text. First, that we take a kind of third-party perspective on our own experience. We become the observer of our own experience, just as we saw in the quieting text, where he talked about watching one's thoughts. We don't get involved. We don't feed the experience. Rather, we pause for a moment and just try to notice, well, what's actually happening inside of us? What is our actual experience at this point? What's the nature of our experience at this moment? The second element is that we're not trying to get rid of anything. We're not opposing anything. We're not pushing something away. We don't notice an experience of, let's say, anger or an experience of some thought that we're not happy with and think, oh, got to get that anger out of me, got to get that thought out of me. In fact, as he points out later, that won't work at all. In fact, the Besh claims that that will simply strengthen that thought or strengthen that anger. This approach is really fundamentally nonviolent. There is no attack. There's no resistance. There's simply presence. And simply when we're willing to be present and observe, then something will happen. We don't need to do anything. We don't need to try to affect that which we're observing. We just observe it, and then we see what happens. And what generally happens is that some kind of space opens up in that process of observation. The Besetzer then continues to talk about this technique and continues later on in the same chapter. Aval im chas v'shalom, kvar igat lidei kach, sheyetzara kvar uchez otcha b'orpecha. But he says, if you really got into this state, where the Yetzer already has you by the neck, right? You're lost in something. You're lost in anger. You're lost in some bad desire, you're lost in some hateful thoughts about people, whatever you're lost in, you're there already. And it's really hard for you to resist it. You want to stop it, but you can't do it, right? You're caught by it. Oh, imeviyu lefanecha mamtakim, umatamim, migarim otcha yoter, v'yitrachasha tavatcha, v'cha beregesh yoter chazak, v'kashe lecha lifrosh mehem. Or he says, what if they bring before you like sweets or delicacies, which pull you after them, right? They're tempting you. And they arouse the desire inside of you. And they make it stronger. And it's very difficult for you to separate from them. Right? You're on a diet. You've decided you're not going to eat something. And all of a sudden it's in front of you. And you find your hand already reaching for the food. And what are you going to do? Ukedei lechalit. להחליק את החטאתך זו בעיניך, רוצה אתה לבטל את דבר כלאחר יד, לאמור ומה בכך אם אוכל אם לא אוכל אלו. הלא כל אנשים אוכלים אותם. It's great, right? He describes their own process. And he says, and you want to sort of ease this experience, this wrongdoing on your part. You know you're failing in your commitment. And you want to just sort of say this whole element you've been trying to do of resisting eating this food is irrelevant. And who cares anyway? Right? What does it matter if I eat it or if I don't eat it? Look, everybody eats this stuff. Right? A fair point. Of course everybody eats it. But the point is that you at this moment are actually making this attempt to have some kind of self-control. You realize that this, whatever it is you're going to eat, isn't going to be good for you. And you're trying to, just for a moment, restrain your desire. Right? So these two cases. One is you're trying to restrain your desire. And the other case is you're already caught in some kind of bad element of the Yetzirah, which could be this desire, but could be something else. So what do you do? Therefore, do what was introduced above and begin to gaze upon your desire. Right? So the first thing you do is just this gazing upon your desire. You're not saying yet whether you're going to do it or not. But before you act on it, wow, maybe you should actually try to notice what's actually happening inside of you. Generally, the cake's already in our mouth before we even notice that we're having this experience of desire. So let's take a moment, let's take a second, and actually observe what's actually happening to us. What is the nature of our experience? As we saw before, this gazing itself, simply this willingness to observe, may already bring a little bit of distance, a little bit of wisdom, a little bit of an ability to then make a wiser decision. And then he says, "Usha'al et atzmecha belibecha." And ask yourself, "Hametu shekol kach tavabi lechozot?" Is it true that I really want this so much? Right, first, you can interrogate your desire. I notice I'm having this experience, but is it really true? Do I really want this so much? And in fact, when we start to notice our desire, we'll see that often it's not true. We really feel this desire for the cake, and then we'll start to notice the desire, and we'll realize, actually, I don't want the cake. What I want is comfort, for instance. And the cake is one way for me to maybe try to seek comfort, but I know it's only going to last for a few minutes. Maybe I should start to work on this comfort thing instead of actually just grabbing for the cake. And he continues in the way you can talk to yourself. So I don't want to talk about now, right now, whether we need to eat it or not need to eat it, right? And it's possible there's nothing actually essentially wrong. There's no sin in eating this thing now, right? There's nothing essentially bad about it. But what I have learned at the moment is that I'm actually quite a desirous person. And in fact, myself is completely given over to my desire. I don't need to figure out right now whether it's the best thing for me to do at this very moment. I don't need to figure out whether I need to do it. But I can just notice, just from my attention to my own experience, wow, how much desire there is in me, and how much I am enslaved to that desire. Quite an interesting and profound insight. In fact, I'm so enslaved, ad shekashe li lifrosh me'ma'achal hazeh. I'm so enslaved that it's difficult for me to separate myself from this food. And we've experienced that, right? We know we shouldn't maybe eat something, and yet we keep eating and we eat it anyway. Wow, totally enchained to some part of ourselves, enslaved literally to some part of ourselves, to our desire. Because, you know, I'm not going to die if I don't eat it, which is a great statement, right? Can we just bring that to mind? It's like, oh yeah, I'm not going to die. A little bit of humor about our situation, a little bit of insight about our situation. And in any case, see how tied I am to it, right? It's great language here. How tied, I'm literally enchained to this desire, to this food, even though it isn't actually essentially important to me in any way. I don't need it physically. I'm not going to die if I don't have it. But still, I'm enslaved to it. And then gaze on your thoughts, on yourself, and on your desire, right? So then you start to observe your thoughts, your experience of yourself, what's actually happening inside. Be engaged in dealing with it, right, in observing it, this odota again about it, and say to yourself, right, he said, look, I knew I wasn't a tzaddik. I knew I wasn't perfect. But that I should be so lowly and such a desirous person, so captured by desire, to the extent that these delicacies would make me helpless before them, I didn't think I was that bad. And that itself, again, is simply a fascinating insight, just to notice the actual operation of desire in you, to bring mindfulness to that situation and notice, wow, okay, I really am unable in many, many cases to resist my desire, to make what I know to be the best choice in this situation. I can't make the best choice in this situation. Habetaleya. So observe it, watch it. V'chazor devarim halalu pam u'shtayim. And repeat these things to themselves a few times. So observe it, notice your experience, and repeat. You know, just notice that, wow, notice how attached I am. Bring that insight to mind. Notice your surprise at that. Notice the humor of it. Play out the exaggeration in your head. Say to yourself, I know I'm not going to die from this, but I'm still so attached to it. And then see and be awed, be surprised. How, with the help of God, your desire will start to weaken and even dissolve completely. Right? It's fascinating. You didn't have to actually, nowhere does he say, and tell yourself, get rid of this desire. It's simply an insight into, an observance first of your actual experience, and then an insight into what's the nature of my experience and what's the nature of my reaction. Oh, this is the experience I'm having. Desire is arising. I'm experiencing desire. And oh, wow, I'm totally enslaved to that desire. I want to do something else, but I can't. In fact, I'm still just reaching for the cake. I'm enslaved to the desire. And wow, see how deep and how shocking that enslavement is. And just with that awareness, when one is willing to observe, when one is willing not to get lost in it, freedom arises. Desire somehow weakens, an open space is created, and one is no longer enslaved. Indeed, elsewhere, the Bizetzner says that this is actually the nature of free will. We think we have free will, but until we're able to observe our experience and therefore have the distance to actually decide whether we want to follow things like our desires, our natural reactions, free will is simply an illusion. Ko ta'aseh b'inyanei achila, v'cho ta'aseh gam b'shar ta'avatcha. Thus you should do in matters of eating, and also with all the rest of your desires, whatever kind of desire it is. So it might be eating. It might be our desire to pursue a certain kind of job, which may or may not be good for us, or to do something in business, which may not be the wisest or most moral thing to do. It may be the desire to see certain kinds of media or popular culture, which may or may not be beneficial for us. It might be a desire for clothes or computer equipment or for whatever it is that does it for us. But instead of just being lost in that desire, can we stop, be present with it, and then actually have the ability to decide whether this is the wise course of action? The point here is not to never follow our desires. Sometimes our desire may in fact be pointing us in the direction of the wise course of action. And that's great. Sometimes you want to have an ice cream. You'll stop and watch, observe, and be like, yeah, I'd like to have an ice cream. Fantastic. But the key is to have the ability to make that choice. To have that sense of openness and freedom which allows you to decide. And he continues, Af b'dibor ezinyan, af shel reshut she'eino avira, aval tov yoter shelo tedaber oto, u'mikom makom mitgareh ata ledaber oto. And he says, it's also the case with speech, right? There's some thing you want to say, something you want to say. And it's a permissible thing. It's not a sin, right? You're not saying something untrue or you're gossiping or saying something terrible about somebody. But it's still better not to say it. And yet in any case, you are drawn to say it. We've all had this experience. Like, there's something, it's like about to come out of your mouth. And if you stopped and paused and considered, you would know that actually it's probably better if I don't say this right now. It's probably better if I don't say it, if I don't express this right now. Not that it's terrible necessarily, but it's not simply going to be the wisest course of action. It's not going to help you or the other person. It's going to cause maybe some hurt feelings in some ways or some confusion. But even though part of us knows that, still, there's some part of us that needs and wants to say it, and we are pulled to say it, even against our own better judgment. So what do? Habet alecha v'al giruecha b'ofen kazeh. Gaze upon yourself. Right? Observe yourself. See this speech you want to do, and see this excitation, this desire to speak. Right? Observe the actual desire and impetus to speak. And then through that place of observation, that place of freedom, all of a sudden one is not as trapped by that experience. One is not enslaved to speech. So here the possessor starts to bring this technique of mindfulness, of observing our own experiences, our emotions, our thoughts, our desires, to our everyday experience. We want to say something. We want to eat something. We want to buy something. And instead of just doing it, let's stop and observe ourselves for a moment and see if that is actually the wisest, most divine course of action. A course of action which is a fulfillment or a violation of being made in the divine image. That momentary pause itself, that willingness to observe our own experience, can be an incredibly liberating and powerful tool and technique. And one which we'll continue to discuss in our next podcast, as we continue to look at texts which discuss this technique of mindfulness in Judaism.